Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the show, we're going to be talking about the new play, Two Wives in India, and we're going to get an update about the legislature and conservation issues. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program Desiree Mays. She is a writer. She's the author of Opera Unveiled, which we're going to be talking about at length another time, but we are not here to talk about opera today.
No, we're not.
We're here to talk about a series that's happening on three Mondays, starting on the 21st of March, called Life is a Creative Process. Is Creativity for Everyone? So, creativity. First of all, creativity means many things to many people. What kind of a definition are you embracing? Sort of every possible kind of creativity?
Exactly. That's how I see it. I think creativity is for everyone. There are different degrees, of course, though I have found in the course of preparing this series that many people conceive of creativity as only for the artist or for the writer. And that's something I think we need to change. I think everybody can be creative from the moment you get out of bed in the morning. You know, what are you going to wear? What are you going to have for breakfast? I mean, if one drags through the day, it's going to be a draggy day. But I think if a little thought goes into that, and there are some creative people who plan their days first thing in the morning, and it's an act of creativity by the end of the day. So that's perhaps the simplest level. But you can get into creativity many, many different ways. I talked with Natalie Goldberg, who literally sits people down and forces them to take up a pen and write. She doesn't take no for an answer. And lo and behold, people write. And they have transformative experiences. Now, these may be people who think, I can't do this. We don't take no for an answer. Creativity is available to everyone, and it comes in many shapes and forms, of course.
Now, that said, there are people who produce, I mean, there's something really wonderful about sitting down and writing and keeping a journal for the first time in your life and seeing things come out of you that you had no idea were there. That doesn't mean it's any good.
Absolutely not, no. And the creative process, there's going to be failure. You're going to run into brick walls. I talked with Murray Gell-Mann, the Nobel Prize winner, and he said creativity is all about obstacles and getting them out of the way. You have to break the rules, which in a way surprised me in the beginning because I don't see it in quite those terms. But if you think about it, even with music, you're in one style of music and those rules are broken. Maybe not broken, but they change and they evolve into something else. So the creativity goes onto another stage. So that can happen. Some people will view creativity as problem solving, and we all know that that's not always going to work. A big part of the creative process is making choices. If and when you've had that flash of illumination, the epiphany, the moment everybody hopes to have, then you have to do the work. You have to sit down and get it out of your head or your heart or your guts or wherever this has come from. And you have to make many, many choices. And many times it may not work. I mean, you may make the wrong choices. You may get disillusioned. The spark will go out. Many things can happen. But I really think, and in talking with all these wonderful people I've spoken to, that the more you do this, the easier it gets, the more open you are to the experience. I mean, Santa Fe is such a place for that. If we're open to experience, those moments do come. And I think that can happen for everyone. We should not shut ourselves down. And this is what I found in the series of these wonderful interviews I've done with a number of people. Too many people, it turned out. Everybody wants to talk about this subject.
Is this going to be a book?
I don't know. When I did this originally, this was in the 1980s, I worked with two women. We were sitting over a cup of coffee and we thought, is the creative process the same for the artist as the dancer, as the physicist, as the housewife? And so we decided we would go and find out. So we did a series of interviews, which were radio interviews. They actually went around the country for NPR. And we interviewed very different people. I was fortunate enough to talk with Willem Kolff, the doctor who designed the artificial heart. And this is a man whose hands are very restless. When I met with him, he had just retired. But he has to be doing things with his hands. So he made this artificial heart and put it into the patient, and it worked. I mean, he also developed the artificial kidney. But this is a man who's constantly thinking, and his very hands are sort of extensions of his thought as he's trying to make things. He picked up a bit of driftwood from the desert and brought it home and put two little tiny beaded buttons in one end of it, and it became a snake, which he gave me. Wonderful examples. So this is where it started. We did this series, and that was years ago. And then I was talking with Jackie M at the O'Keeffe Museum. She's doing a series of creativity topics, and she said, "What about doing something like this again?" So that I would go out and talk with different people from different disciplines, and that was interesting in and of itself. I had so many people I could have talked to, but couldn't include all, and there had to be. I don't know if you'd call it creative, but there had to be a way of bringing this together where it would be cohesive, where one would lead to another and make sense. And yet you'd still get the contrast of a creative mathematician, an investment banker, an artist, a writer. Is the process the same? I think the bottom line, without giving anything away, is actually the process is the same, but the language is different. How we describe it and how we bring it to life is described and thought of quite differently by different people. The great writer Natalie Goldberg doesn't even use the word creativity. She says, "I don't like that word because it locks you into what people's perceptions of creativity are." And I think it's a word I like to use because I think it's available and up there for everyone.
I think one of the most creative acts that I can think of in our sort of fairly recent history is Charles Darwin looking at these great hills that show different strata of geological time and making the leap from that to understanding that species evolved over time that corresponded to this geological time, mm-hmm. and that those very rocks would have clues, mm-hmm. that they weren't all created by God at the same moment and so on. I mean, that creative leap is so huge. We take it for granted now, but there was a moment when nobody had thought of that. And what's so interesting about the creative process is that it was all right there, waiting to be discovered, waiting to be seen, but it actually took somebody to see it. And then after that, probably everybody else said, "Oh, yeah, I could have thought of that."
That's right. And that happens in science all the time, of course. I mean, people often come at the same moments of illumination simultaneously, which is always an issue because it depends then as to who gets into the publications first as to who gets the credit. But I think that's an unanswerable question. What is the flash, the illumination, the spark that makes that connection? I don't think that's understood and maybe can't be understood. I'm more interested in the form that it takes. What do you have to do to be in a place where your brain can make those connections?
I think being obsessive is probably helpful.
Yeah, and being aware of taking in of everything of life around you. Judy Chicago talked of when she realized there was a problem that women's art was a non-event in the 70s. It just wasn't out there. So she went back to history, to women's history, to see what she could find and began to make her connections from that. Murray Gell-Mann talked about he was completely stuck on solving one of these major issues that in particle physics. And it was one day when he was giving a talk on the topic that he made a slip of the tongue. He gave a wrong number. And it was the right number. That was amazing to him. He's written a book, the Quark and the Jaguar, and he describes it in this book. And we talked about that. I don't think it's quite understood what that's about, but the form in which it takes and what you do with it and how thrilling that is for anyone, for most people, I hope, who have had those moments of, aha, that's it, or I had the idea, or it occurred to me. This is what we do this all the time. We really do. It occurred to me that this would work. Let's give it a try in whatever discipline we work. And I have many examples through the course of different people that this has happened to.
We're talking to Desiree Mays. So you're going to do 3 Mondays, and you're going to share some of the interviews that you have been doing with all these people whom you've been mentioning.
Right.
And allow audiences also to participate in some way?
Yes, I've toured. I've been sort of touring the state, not quite the state, but the Santa Fe area, getting these interviews. People have been very generous. I would go to a home, somewhere that was quiet, preferably, to do the interview. And what I will do is present an abbreviated version. The interviews ran from 40 minutes to an hour and a half. And
yeah.
Obviously, we can't do that. So I'll take an edited amount, and then we will listen to it, and we'll talk about it. We'll talk about the issues that each person I interviewed brings up. That'll be very rich. And then a major part of the series is to, jumpstart, extend, encourage the creative process of people who come. So there will be an aspect of it will be to choose one's own creative project, and not to come up with do a completed painting by the end of 3 weeks. It's to get the idea, to get it started, and to think about the process. What did you go through, and how is this helping you? I must say, a lot of the things that I do now, which are very varied, I go back sometimes and I think, actually, yes, this absolutely fit the process. Four stages. Information collecting, you collect all the pieces, they wander around in your brain, and then something happens that moment and it pulls together somehow, and then you have to work it through and make it happen. That was my going out and doing all these interviews and then bringing them together in a way that would be interesting, I hope, and provocative. It'll raise questions, and then to get people enthusiastic about doing something about it on their own. Not just sitting back and watching this, as we tend to do in front of our televisions, perhaps, we're out of it. Interact when you go to a theater, an opera, a ballet, concert. I think we need to be involved emotionally. And out of that, great ideas can come, too.
I think there are people who say, I'd like to do something creative, but they're in their same context of their house and office and so on that they're in every day.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they go to a new place and have maybe a new context or even are given a problem or even an assignment, things flow out of them that wouldn't flow out at home.
That's right. You have to break beyond the box. I mean, that's so clear. You need to be able to always. I was walking out of the community college the other day and going to find my car in the car park past a line of cars. And I had an idea. I wonder what are the stories of the people who drove these cars here this morning? Now, that's a little simple creative idea, but that could lead to a nice piece of writing. You could just sit down and write, make up stories about the people who drove their car that morning into that car park, just from looking at their cars. So it's out there, and it's just a matter of, it's a matter of being aware, of being curious, of asking questions, and not always taking no for an answer. I know I interviewed one writer who I said, what's the hardest part of the creative process for you? She writes biographies of famous people like Warren Buffett, and she said, you know, the hardest part is getting the first interview. Don't take no for an answer. So I listened to that, and that worked. And so I've been really, Mary Shar, honored and thrilled that I was able to meet with these people and that they would share and talk with me. They're all interested in this topic. I was in Ireland, taking care of my mother off on the wilds of West Cork. And next door there was going to be a Shanachie, an Irish storytelling festival. So I went. It was very noisy. People drank a lot of Guinness. And then this singer Shanachie came on, Colm Sands, and the place you could have heard a pin drop. He sang what the music is, music of rebel songs that we all know, but his message is about peace. So I met with him afterwards and I said, is there any chance that we could sit and talk? He said, well, I'll be here tomorrow morning for breakfast and I'm leaving. He has this wonderful Northern Ireland accent. So we sat and we talked for 2 hours over that breakfast looking out of the sea about his creativity. And he loved it because he had never really approached what he does in this way before. But it rang bells for him and it sparked ideas. It was very rich. And they've all been a bit like that for different reasons.
When we think about creativity and creative people, as you said, a lot of people think about artists and scientists, and indeed, there are people who have changed the life of generations because of their work, and most of us, to be honest, don't.
Right.
But the thing that I think is, I think one of the reasons that this is so important and so much on people's minds is that throughout the history of civilization, people have had to do things like make their clothes, make their furniture, build their house, grow their food. Now we don't do any, most of us don't do any of those things, or do one of them every once in a while or something. But you go to a store and buy a pair of pants. You go to Trader Joe's and buy those wonderful marinated fish things and whatever. And then there's all of this. I mean, it's easier. We have time to do our, many people would say, uncreative jobs.
But what
and then
do
there's
we
this,
do with
all
it?
This unfulfilled, just basically doing, even if you're not some generation-changing genius, just doing things with your hands and doing those little things that are just built into the wiring of who we are.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, we're well on the way to becoming zombies, if you put it that way. And if this convenience age that we live in is allowing us free time for other things, that's a good question. What are we doing that's creative, that's contributing to the greater good of the whole with that other time?
Or do we have that time? Is it just taken away from us to the system which demands continually increased productivity?
Right. Are we just sitting in front of our computers, you know, not really interacting beyond being with a machine? I talked with Deborah Madison, the wonderful chef who lives out in Galisteo, and she talked about, she said, you know, there's no comparison. You can go in a store and you can buy a bag of spinach, okay? It has no life to it. It's pretty yucky. Or you can go to the market and you can handle that spinach. And she got so excited and happy about just describing the freshness, the bounce, the smell of the spinach. And we all know what she's talking about at the simplest level. She said that's what she cooks with. She goes back and that's what she includes. And she said, right the way along the line to preparing a meal, it's rich and enriched, both for her and the people who enjoy it.
And that's engagement with materials, whether those be pigments or food or whatever, or wood, whatever it is that is your medium.
It was a lesson for me when I was thinking of coming here in the early 1990s. I went out to Tsuke Pueblo, and the potter, the matriarch of this family, was making pottery. She had her daughters and stepdaughters and cousins, all the women that were around, and the children. And the children were playing with the different colored sands. It was very hands-on, and there was a happiness and a joy to this group of women, from babies to the grandmother, that blew me away. I looked at them and I thought, you know, who has it right? This family, where they're making art, their children are getting involved with their hands, or me stuck back in Washington, D.C. in an office with no window in front of a computer. That was one of my reasons for moving here. That was a creative leap. I've done a few of those, but that was one of the better ones.
And a lot of people, I suppose, come out to the big open land of the West for the same reason.
Well, yeah, people come out here for all sorts of creative reasons, probably. I mean, it's not always practical. Practicality may not be always the best way to go. I mean, the limitations of staying within the square box, you don't want to do that. Always look beyond.
And the thing is, you know, the thinking outside the box has become its own cliche.
Yes,
it's become its own sort of beaten to death metaphor. But there is something about, and it's hard to always do, but basically taking off the filters that you have learned. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when you walk to your car, as an example that you gave before, from being inside the grocery
building,
store or whatever, your only real practical goal is to get to your car and drive away.
Right.
And to stay safe in the process, not get hit or mugged or something like that. But if you, and so nothing else matters. So you filter everything out. So when you decide to stop filtering everything out, and you notice the colors of the cars and where the license plates are from and what it smells like. And
you begin to imagine. You open up that whole other world. I mean, I love walking because there's all sorts of things that you can absorb and think about and be aware of. I mean, in that car park, there was a young couple, a young Hispanic couple, who were just standing with their arms around each other. It was very sweet and very touching. And that sort of made my day. I mean, instead of just being blinkered, go to my car, drive home, and that's available to everyone all the time. And what you do with it is up to you. I mean, for starting exercises, Natalie Goldberg is a mistress of this. But if you, like we're sitting here in the Radio Cafe and there's a bright yellow wall in front of me, what does the color yellow mean? In this case, it means Mexican restaurant to me. It's those sort of bright in-your-face colors. But look around. There's also a painting with a yellow flower. Think of the yellows. Think of connecting the yellows. There's many things you can do to bring out creativity. And it's great fun. I think you're right about filtering. I think there's a way of stripping off a lot of what we have built up or has been built up around us and being very honest with ourselves. Writing can do that. I mean, you can write and find yourself in areas you may not have wanted to go that are hurtful or painful. If you're writing about the death of a loved one, for instance, but maybe that'll be very cathartic to be able to go through that and come to terms with it. There are many benefits, but it comes from a very simple thing of just being aware. And with writing, certainly, to sit down and write through it can be hard, but you can come out of it fulfilled and you know, really happy. One other aspect of these three Mondays, of course, we haven't mentioned, is that on March 28th, the second one, I've invited two great people to come and just sit and have a conversation and rap about creativity. And those two people are yourself, Mary Charlotte will be there. James Keller, who is a wonderful musicologist and the critic, music critic for the New Mexican paper. So we will sit and talk about creativity, and the group will be included in that. It'll be a discussion. And that's on the 28th. So hopefully people will be able to make all three. That would be great.
Desiree Mays is leading an event. It's a series of three Mondays, March 21st, 28th, and April 4th, from 6 to 7:30, and it's at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex on Grant Avenue here in Santa Fe. For more information and to register, you can go to o'keeffemuseum.org, and then you can go to the adult learning, adult classes, and you'll see Life is a Creative Process. You can also call 946-1039. Desiree,
right.
Yeah, thank you so much. This has been
Thanks very much, Mary Charlotte. Hope to see everyone later in March.
Excellent. Thank you. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Leslie Harrell Dillon and Kent Kirkpatrick. Leslie has written and is in a new play directed by Kent. It's called Two Wives in India, and it opens this Thursday at the Santa Fe Playhouse. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning. Thank
Good
you.
Good morning. Great to see you.
Great to have you both back on the program. Now, Leslie, this is a play that contains, shall we say, autobiographical material.
Yes, it does.
Tell us about it. Two wives in India, a mother and a stepmother of a girl who was about to get married to an Indian man.
Yes, to a Sikh who was born and raised in Delhi.
Now, not an Espanola Sikh.
No, an Espanola Sikh.
An Indian Sikh.
And I'm the stepmother, and this is about my stepdaughter, who I'm very close to. And 3 years ago, almost to the day, 3 years ago, February, we went over to India for an engagement party for my stepdaughter and her fiancé, because much of the Indian family would not be able to attend the wedding, which was going to be held the following June in Montana, where Abby had been working as an environmental lawyer. So it was a chance for the whole Indian family over there, both from South India and North India, to celebrate my stepdaughter and future son-in-law. And so we were there along with my husband's first wife and her family. So we were all together in close quarters there for 10 days, traveling and being with each other. It was very, very special, and I was very tense, but I didn't want anyone to know it. And so I would go home and write in my journal a lot and then present the good, you know, my Oklahoma City face, like, oh, yeah, isn't this fun? This is so great. I'm so tense. I'm going to go home and write.
Which is, I guess, how a lot of artists, playwrights, comedians, and people get through life.
Yes, it's so wonderful. Years ago, as an actress, I was taught by my mentor, Sanford Meisner, use it, use it, use it. Whatever's happening to you, use it, you know. So.
And so you've made this play which has different twists on the reality that happened.
Yes.
The main two characters are the mother and the stepmother.
Right.
And in the play, the mother has really not been the one who loved and raised the child, maybe the way one would have hoped. But the stepmother is also close to her.
Actually, the mother and the daughter are very, very close. And in the play, this time I am playing the first wife. I felt it was important not to play my role,
right,
the stepmother, but to play the first wife. And the first wife is actually extremely close to her daughter. I mean, the kind of mother-daughter thing, like, you know, I love my daughter more than anything in the entire world. I would say that this mother is a little bit difficult maybe for other people, but I think for Emily, the daughter, she adores her mother, but she's also ready to go off on her own. And I think it's very hard for the mother to let her go. And I think it has been hard for her to share her with a person like the second wife, Mary Jo, who is a very warm and loving and eccentric, romantic stepmother, all, kind of the opposite of what this first wife is.
The first wife is a sort of fashion-conscious, chic New York
exactly,
lady.
Exactly, an interior designer who's very precise about life and very much in control of things and know how things should be done. She's not a romantic. I think she has a romantic streak in her, and that was what happened when she met Sam, and she thought she might be able to be that kind of person, but indeed she could not be. She just had much more of a need to succeed and to control than the kind of, you know, creative bohemian life that she might have continued to live with Sam if they'd stayed together.
And so when Sam remarried, he really found his match.
Exactly. He and Mary Jo are just like two peas in a pod, and they're just great.
Now, in the play, Sam is dead.
Exactly. My husband in life is not dead. He's very much alive.
But he plays, what's interesting is that he actually is on stage as a ghost, whereas Emily, who's very much alive and is the daughter, never shows up.
Exactly. She, in one reading of the play, many drafts ago, I think it was around draft 10, I did have Emily show up to see what would happen, and it threw the play so much in another direction around mothers and daughters and the competition for love that it became much less about the two women and the culture and the Indian son-in-law, and she just, it didn't feel right. I thought, well, that's interesting, but that's another play, so it was much more powerful for me to have her off stage.
And so the tension between the mother and the stepmother is palpable,
right,
and very well played, and I mean, you'd get nervous just sitting. I mean, I went to the rehearsal as one does, and was just nervous about this. Oh no, you know, you sort of cringe, which I guess is what you were after.
Exactly. I love that you had that reaction.
So, Kent, you are directing this, I guess. I mean, you have to see it as a play. Does the fact that it's autobiographical play, in some ways, play a role at all in your directing of it?
Well, it does, but we've worked really hard to fictionalize it. So even though it's based in a real event in Leslie's life, we've fictionalized it a lot. And we've worked in development with our actors. We started around Christmas, I guess, and Leslie had a production of this play last fall at the Boston Playwrights Theater, and so she had just come fresh from that experience with some things that she wanted to alter and develop and deepen and stuff like that. So we really worked on fictionalizing this. So it's always makes you a little crazy because there is the real Leslie and there is the real story and there is, you know, a lot of reality in this, but we have fictionalized this tremendously. It comes from a true place, but we've tried to find another fictional truth.
Which, of course, definitely has to make it better because
you can't
put reality on the stage.
Right, right. I don't want to for my sake, but also for my family's sake.
Right.
You know, when it was a solo piece and very autobiographical, my stepdaughter saw it and she said, "Oh, Leslie, you know, I'm a big fan, but this is not transformed yet." And having that word transformation in suddenly from her reaction, I thought, "Oh, that's what this play really needs. I need to transform this and make this another creature."
Because I think it becomes more universal.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. Now, the luxury, I guess, I think of it as a luxury of being able to develop it and have it performed in one place and then change it and tweak it and then have a rather long development process here in Santa Fe. What's that been like?
Oh, it's been thrilling. It's my favorite thing to do. I love doing it so much.
And Kent is so fabulous doing it.
Well, and it's, you know, it's so much fun to have a play right there. You know, Leslie and I work together, so we would work with the actors, and the actors brought a lot of who they are and their own personal truths to Leslie's characters, but always, you know, with her blessing. So we would bounce things up. I mean, she's there, so she's always a part of the process. So it's very exciting to bring a bunch of creative minds together and, you know, from her initial impulse to expand it and deepen it and just make it better, more theatrical.
The way the play works is that they're the characters of the mother and the stepmother. Emily is always just a few feet off stage, I guess. But the son-in-law-to-be, the fiancé, the Indian man, the Sikh, is very much a part of the play. And then there's this wonderful device of using two other actors who play many roles.
Right,
How does that work?
Well, they are actually came to me in one of the rewrites before I went to Boston, and they are named Miri and Piri, and those are actual names of the two curved swords on either side of the center Sikh, the symbol. When you look at the Sikh symbol, there's a large two-edged sword in the middle, and then these two curved swords on either side named Miri and Piri, and they stand for the spiritual and temporal aspects of universal life. And because the Sikhs believe we are all one under God, I really loved those names, and I loved that idea of the temporal and spiritual. And there's so much of that in the play of spiritual spirituality underneath everything. So personifying them and then having them be shapeshifters and role players made it very theatrical and magical for me, which is what I really wanted the play to be. I really wanted to engage the audience's imagination, that is far beyond TV or movies, that it becomes, you know, transformational for the audience in that way that right. that these characters do. So transformation and their ability to transform is a real strong metaphor for me about how life works.
And they're pragmatically a great theatrical device, because they can lead us to place to place to place and transition, because the play does move very quickly. I mean, we start at the airport, and we're in a taxi, and then we're at the hotel, and then, you know, on and on and on and on. So Leslie calls it an emotional travelogue. And there are many, many places and settings. And so those two actors who represent those two forces, not only do they play all the other characters, but they provide a theatrical device to shift us, the audience's mind and eye, to the next place.
And it just reminds you, I mean, in a movie you have to have a million different actors playing those, but in a play you get to use, as the audience, your imagination.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is key for me.
Now, this play opens this Thursday night, and it runs from Thursday through the 3rd of April at the Santa Fe Playhouse. There's a big gala event
right.
on Friday night, and performances are Thursday and Friday and Saturday at 8 and Sunday at 2. You can go to santafeplayhouse.org for more information, or call 988-4262. When this run is done, what happens to the play next?
Yes, Kent and I.
We're trying to get it in other theaters. I think it's a great play. I think it has commercial life in store for it. It's written from a playwright voice that we don't hear often. You know, there are not that many female playwrights and female actors, you know, middle-aged women who write plays. And I think the point of view is original, and I think having the two women as lead characters is could be very successful for theaters across the country. So we're trying to get it out.
Well, it's funny, it's great fun to watch, and it's great to have you both on the air, Leslie Harold Dillon and Kent Kirkpatrick. Leslie is the playwright and actor in the new play Two Wives in India, directed by Kent Kirkpatrick. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I'd like now to welcome back to the show Leanne Leith. She is political director of Conservation Voters New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So we have, during this legislative session, been talking about all sorts of things with Linda Siegel and various people, driver's licenses and health care. And at the very beginning of the session, we talked to Sandy Buffett of Conservation Voters New Mexico. But let's get an update now on conservation and anti-environment bills going through or being stalled in the New Mexico legislature at this point. What does it look like? What's going on?
Well, actually, we have some good news to report. And I think when Sandy was on the show earlier in the session, things looked rather dire. There were a lot of anti-conservation bills out there, and some of them were moving. And we are now, there. I think in total there are about 65 or 70 anti-conservation bills that we were opposing. And, at, you know, going into the last 4 days of session, we're down to about maybe 10 or 12 that are still moving and still have life. The rest are all stalled in committee. And so, you know, the legislature has actually done, I think, a pretty good job of reviewing these bills very thoroughly. There still, unfortunately, are a few out there.
What are some of the really, in your view, most egregious ones that have not gone forward?
Well, there are a few, more than a few, actually. There was one bill that hasn't moved out of the House. In fact, it hasn't moved out of its first committee. It would have required economic impact statements for rules that are adopted by agencies. And rules are the things that protect our public health, safety, welfare. And what it would have required are these economic impact statements that an agency would have had to do to estimate what the cost of a rule would be. And if they underestimated the cost of a rule, that would come directly out of the agency budget, which we thought was a rather creative way of being punitive towards agencies who want to safeguard public health and safety.
And that didn't go anywhere.
No, that hasn't gone anywhere. There was another one that was moving. And it was actually had some quite a bit of heft behind it. And this was the cultural properties bill. And what it would have done is put unbelievable hurdles in front of any cultural property or cultural historic site designation. And just such that probably there would never be another designation of a cultural site in New Mexico ever again. And you know how important cultural properties are to the state of New Mexico.
And that also did not have any traction.
No. On the House and Senate side, both of them got out of a single committee but didn't stalled in their next committee.
So what are we looking at now?
Well, we have still have some bills that are moving that, you know, we have some concerns about. There are bills that would gut our renewable portfolio standard. There's House Bill 546, which was stalled in House Business and Industry Committee about 2 weeks ago, and they pulled it off the table last week. And for those who are familiar with New Mexico's renewable energy standard, there are a lot of states across the country that have these set amounts, these targets, that standards that we have to reach for the percentage of renewable energy that has to be in a utility's portfolio. And New Mexico's rule is 20% by 2020 renewable energy with benchmarks along the way. And this bill would have cut that in half and essentially set the
10%
amount,
by 2020.
Yeah, which we're already at almost 10%. So
right.
So it basically would have stalled all renewable energy. And one of the problems is the renewable energy industry is the one of the fastest growing sectors of the economy, whereas I think overall job growth in New Mexico has been about 1.9% over the last 5 to 6 years. Renewable energy growth has been 65%.
Oh my goodness.
So it's huge. It's
and
huge.
We've talked about that with New Energy Economy, yes, on more than one occasion, whose position, and with a lot of evidence, is that there are hundreds of billions of dollars in this world waiting to be spent from venture capital alone on new energy projects.
Absolutely. And all they need is the market signal. That's all they need is the market signal. And as soon as you start changing the rules of the game as you go along, you actually are deterring investment more than if you hadn't imposed the rules in the first place, because they just don't know. There's also one other bill I want to talk about on the anti-conservation side, and it's a little bit arcane, but there's a bill that's going to be on the Senate floor sometime in the next few days. It's Senate Bill 415. It's sponsored by Senator Beffert, and it's called Utility Cost Limits, which sounds like the really exciting bill. Mm-hmm. But what it does right now in our renewable portfolio standard, when utilities are implementing that standard, there is actually a cost threshold requirement or a cost threshold cap, so that if it costs them too much to comply, there's sort of an off-ramp,
right,
where they have an escape valve. And right now the Public Regulation Commission has the authority to set what that cost cap is, and they've got it set at 2%, but ramping up to 3%, which is actually very minimal when you look at what utilities have been asking for in terms of rate increases because of the cost of conventional fuels, oil and gas, cost of oil and gas increases. That's a very small amount. And what this bill would do is set in statute a 2% cap. So it would take all of the flexibility away from the PRC. And I think even worse is that because of the way it's set in statute, There wouldn't be any opportunity for investment because the costs aren't amortized over the life of a project. So the 2% cap would prevent any capital investment up front, even if over 10 years that renewable energy investment would be dramatically less expensive than the conventional fueled alternative.
And might even make money, who knows?
Exactly.
The that's one of those kind of the devil is in the details bill. Like, it doesn't stand out to the typical listener as, well, what's wrong with that? But it actually doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. And in the end, again, it would be a huge market signal not to invest in renewable energy because utilities are not going to be demanding it.
And so that's something that people can call their senators about?
Absolutely. Call your senators at the Capitol. All you have to do is call the Capitol number at 986-4300 to get connected to your senator.
We're talking to Leanne Leith from Conservation Voters New Mexico. Are there any pro-environment, help the environment bills that have gone anywhere?
There actually are, and some of them, you know, it's interesting. A lot of the more ambitious ones haven't moved, and I don't think that that's particularly a surprise to anyone. But there are these great bills that seem smaller but are going to have huge impacts. One is House Bill 145, which has made it all the way through the House, through its first Senate committee. Right now it's sitting in Senate Finance Committee. And it is Representative Stewart's High Performance School Buildings Act. And what this would do is increase the opportunity for schools to invest in high-performance technologies that will save water, save energy, and frankly, in the end, save operating costs because it's going to save on their water and utility bills.
Right.
And it's a great bill, and hopefully it'll be able to make it through. The problem is there's a bit of a logjam in Senate Finance Committee, so we're trying to get bills out of there. And there's a similar bill, actually. Senator Keller, Tim Keller, has a Senate Bill 237, which actually just passed out of House Energy and Natural Resources Committee yesterday. And it is a bill that adds, right now, there is an Energy Efficiency Bonding Act that allows public facilities, state buildings, and public schools to access bond money to invest in renewable energy and energy efficiency, and then basically, those bonds are serviced by the savings in the operating costs over the life of the building. And Senator Keller's bill would expand that to allow post-secondary institutions to take advantage of that. So obviously, it's a great bill.
There is another issue that's going on in New Mexico that is not exactly a legislative issue, but it's something that's important to talk about, which is that Bill Dupuy did a very good story on this not too long ago. There is an entity that was called together by Governor Martinez called the Small Business Task Force that I thought was supposed to be a task force to really help mom-and-pop businesses in the state of New Mexico. What's the reality of that task force?
Well, that's a great question. And we obviously had a lot of questions about it. They announced that the task force was being established, but they didn't announced the membership of the task force, and that didn't come to light until some enterprising reporters submitted Inspection of Public Records Act requests to find out what the composition of that task force was. And we were concerned when we saw the membership because they don't actually seem to be, or there doesn't seem to be much, if any, representation from small business or what most people would think of as small business, mom and pop shops. What they tend to be are either lobbyists or principals in large businesses, large industries, many of them out of state, where their employers or their clients are out of state industry.
Hang on, the Small Business Task Force of New Mexico has members on it who are heads of large out-of-state businesses?
Well, they're lobbyists or clients for large out-of-state businesses. So, for example, there's a member of the task force who has a large number of out-of-state oil and gas and mining company clients. And that's who he lobbies for in the roundhouse. And that's not, I don't think it's unusual when you look at the full list of members of the task force. We just don't find the mom-and-pop shops, the ones who really need the help.
So what is this task force coming up with?
Well, they met, as we understand it, they met twice, although we believe that there's still more information coming to light about what sort of their conclusions are and what their recommendations are. But what we can see is that from the meeting minutes that have come out from the two meetings that they had, is it does appear to be the, I would say, the legislative agenda of big industry. So the Small Business Task Force recommended changes in law that jibe almost perfectly with the legislative agenda of oil and gas, mining, big dairy, industrial dairy, et cetera.
For example?
One of the pieces of legislation that was moving very quickly through was House Bill 297, which was basically how the state treats inactive oil and gas wells. And it was a big issue for many of the oil and gas producers. And what they wanted, frankly, was to get a longer time frame for dealing with their inactive wells without having to post financial assurance or test those wells for mechanical integrity. And, you know, those tests are really important. Inactive wells are a huge vector for groundwater contamination. And so you need those tests before you leave a well sitting out there,
right,
to make sure that that you're not contaminating our groundwater.
From what I know of that task force, their major thrust seems to be to disable any and all environmental regulation. Environmental regulation, while maybe some of these regulations are imperfect, I don't know them in as much detail as you, but they really just exist to make sure that we're not drinking benzene and stuff like that, aren't they?
Pretty much, yes. You know, these are and what sometimes people forget too is the Environment Department, which is responsible for most of the environmental regulations, aren't just responsible for environmental regulations. It's also pool safety, worker safety, you know, the convenience store regulations that were passed a few years ago that have made convenience store workers safe. It used to be the most dangerous job in New Mexico. That was all done by the Environment Department. We're talking about saving people's lives. But yes, air quality, we're talking about the pollutants and the contaminants that are causing major health problems among young people particularly, as well as our senior citizens. And the dairy waste regulations that were just adopted by the Water Quality Control Commission that will protect our drinking water. These are all very, very important rules. And if you look at what came out of the Small Business Task Force, almost to a rule, their recommendation is either to rescind, repeal, or revise these rules.
And also to try to figure out a way to not let Environment Department officials enforce the existing rules.
Yes. And actually, that's been also a theme in some of the legislation we've seen is, you know, you can't pass laws that are retroactive. You can't pass a legislation that would apply to previous cases. So, for example, when they've been trying to repeal rules, some of the bills, you know, they've tried to repeal, but there are constitutional issues with doing that. So they've indicated that these are prospective, that it would affect rulemaking prospectively. But one of the bills, and this was a bill that was actually stalled in House Energy and Natural Resources Committee yesterday, and this was House Bill 579, Representative Taylor's, that was going after greenhouse gas emissions and the carbon rules. And what it did, although it was presented as a prospective bill, it prevented any agency from enforcing existing rules on greenhouse gases. And something else to keep in mind is we think of greenhouse gases as uniquely climate change, but they're also air pollutants that we need that are actually air contaminants that have major public health impacts.
Leanne Leith is with Conservation Voters New Mexico. There's much more to talk about, but we're just out of time. Anything else that you want to let people know before we go?
Really quickly, I promise, but folks should know that the Environment Department, the State Environment Department's budget was cut by over 19% in its general fund appropriation, and this is a huge concern for anybody who, I mean, this is restaurant inspections, it's oil and gas, it's really important, and unfortunately, I think we're going to see a lot less enforcement of our existing safeguards, the common sense safeguards on which we depend.
Leanne Leith, thanks for being with us, and we hope to see you after the session to talk more about environmental issues in New Mexico.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.